With all my limitations, physical and mental, I have only tried to tell what happened, and even if it should be considered a waste of time, I felt it necessary to do so, because of the religious theme involved. It is stupid of me perhaps to expect that others should feel about this what I felt. Men will continue to be born into their present-day beliefs. Besides, as long as this, our civilization, is cursed with the sense of possession and contempt, I presume my experience shall only be a reason to find myself very close to ridicule. But I feel that some of what I believe shall be of value. Especially what the 7 cosmic commandments concern, and of which I shall write about as the last chapter. Perhaps they may become little seeds for the future. There are matters on which I have had to maintain my privacy. Even the French philosopher Rousseau, in the course of his Confessions, narrates incidents that have profoundly shocked his contemporary fellow human beings. As far as I am concerned, and especially as far as the sexual habits of the Etobicarians are concerned, I have tried to reveal exactly nothing, and I believe I do have the right to do this, simply because our own sexual habits are far from free. Telling about the sexual pattern and the erotic behavior of out-of-space people would again come very close to science fiction. In a way, I felt it an obligation to write all this, as I have said, because of my belief in God. I am devoid of personal pride, and it doesn't matter much if people agree with me or not. Besides, I think it extremely silly to achieve immortality by inventions or literary creations. In a few hundred years, even the most important works of art are forgotten, and only very few of them are of schoolroom interest or shown in a few dusty museums. Chapter 19. The Tragedy of Planet Tagra. About 2 weeks after I had taken over the property on the lake, a curious thing happened. I was working steadily on the lower terrace, under the imut tree. All morning typing had not been easy. Also, it was nearing noon and the sun was hot. Suddenly my left hand got numb, and I thought this to be from overworking on the typewriter. But, suddenly, I felt a burning on my ring finger, and it felt as though a mischievous boy was of causing the sun's rays through an invisible magnifying glass onto the middle joint of my finger. I tried in a hurry to take off the ring and saw the insert flashing and gleaming, as though it were a miniature sun itself. I left my desk underneath the tree and stepped up into the central terrace and the cool of the house, well away from the direct rays of the sun. The metal still gleamed and glowed with the fire all its own, even though I had placed the ring on top of the kitchen table. Then I knew that my friends from Etobicara would soon be getting in touch with me, as in Benares and Lima. I was overjoyed. I went into the bathroom and found some ointment, which I applied to the fiery spot on my finger. Never before had the ring affected my nerves like this. But then, suddenly, observing the ring, I noticed that the light from the metallic inset had dimmed. I went to my bedroom and lay down in order to think. Besides, my heart was pounding and I needed the rest. My housekeeper came to ask if anything was wrong. She knew that I usually worked through to 1 o'clock before taking a drink, lunch, and then rest. I assured her that everything was all right, and asked her if she could hurry lunch, as I was almost certain that I would be having a vegetarian diet for a long time. However, the more I thought of it, the more I liked the idea. I was convinced that one of their control ships had given me the signal and would visit the lake, perhaps at night. I put on the ring, this time on my right hand, and went outside the house again. All thoughts of continuing with my work had vanished. I climbed the stairs to the topmost terrace and gazed over the lake. The placid waters lapped the shores, the islets, the little fishing boats. Nothing disturbed the calm of this beautiful day of January 15th. Somewhat disappointed, I went back inside the house and started to eat my lunch. But I did not enjoy my steak. Nervous as a schoolboy, I got up again and started to have a second drink. This, in the tropical heat before night, was no good. I snapped out of it, and went back to the garage on the top terrace and once more carefully scanned the lake. A small sailing boat was lazily tacking up to Los Guardos and Los Patos Isles towards the far side of the lake. But there was no sign of any spacecraft, and the sky, too, was innocent of spacecraft. I sat down under the imut tree and tried to concentrate on the typewriter. But where words had once flowed, now they eluded me. I got up in disgust, wandered back into the house, moved around for all the world like a lost puppy casting for familiar smells. Eventually, I felt so restless that I decided to take the small outboard motorboat and take a dip in the waters of a sandy beach near the Isla del Alto, or as some natives call it, the Isla de los Dioses, the Island of Gods. So named because past volcanic eruptions have pushed from the very bowels of the lake this giant black pinnacle of a rock that gives the appearance of an immense, natural altar. I had been there already the first week of my arrival. From the Isla de los Dioses one can obtain the most breathtaking view over the central part of the lake. So, before taking my dip, I steered to a landing spot from which a path ran upwards to a volcanic terrace that commanded the entire sweep of this aquatic paradise. After I had eased the motorboat inshore, I tied it up to a branch of an overhanging tree, and trudged up the path that led to the highest point of the altar rock. I had almost reached the top of the face when it occurred to me that I had come to take a dip. But this was the wrong time, I thought suddenly, to take a swim. Instead, I scouted around for the most suitable spot where I could stretch out and observe the sky. But unfortunately, the tiny leaves from the Iskan trees that grow on the island afforded little protection from the heat of the afternoon sun. So I continued my search for a shady tree. I passed the nests of a few chilos, but the birds were uncommonly silent. The people of Central America love these medium-sized birds, that they affectionately call the racket bird. This is because of the row that it kicks up when there is good news for the hearer. The chilos were strangely silent. I took a short breather before climbing to the topmost point of the north face. From this resting place, the lake, the islands and the mountains are an artist's palette run riot. The glorious panorama stretches to the haze that is the border of Honduras and Nicaragua. I let the beauty of the view seep into my soul. Soothed by the enchantment of nature's beauty, I felt the cloud lift from my mind, the excitement fade from my body. Once more I studied the still waters of the lake. Suddenly, I noticed a change in the surface waters. They were roughed by several huge, concentric circles. It was as if some playful giant had thrown an enormous stone right bang in the middle of the lake in order to ripple the placid waters. I looked at my watch, it was coming up to 4. I scanned the lake. There was no large ship that could have accounted for the concentric circles. I turned my cheek to the wind. There was but a gentle breeze, certainly not enough to have disturbed the waters. There could be but one explanation for those circles. Somewhere near at hand, my friends from Itibiratu had effected a landing. I was not worried because I had not seen the spacecraft. They touch down and take off so quickly that, unless one is watching the precise landing spot, it is very difficult to see an actual landing. The concentric rings, however, were good enough evidence for me. In order to obtain a better view of the rings, which could be observed moving out wider and wider over the surface of the lake, I changed my vantage point, and strolled round to the southwesterly side of the rock face. I had only just turned the angle of the face when I received the shock of my life. Satura was sitting on the broad ledge. He was so motionless that he seemed to be carved out of the very living rock itself. I approached my friend. Satura slowly turned and faced me. He was inexpressibly sad. I noticed that his clothing was of a dark green, that he wore a broad instrument belt, on which was a much larger talking device than the one to which I had become accustomed when I had stayed with him at the Mirim Flavor Station. He motioned to me to come and sit alongside him. This I did, although the black, volcanic rock ledge on which he was sitting offered no protection from the sun. As I sat down, I became possessed of a feeling of deep contentment. It was as if he had thrown an aura of peace over me, the peace of mind that was part of the normal emotional makeup of the Itibirans. I was so relaxed that I smiled at him and asked, "Where is Xiti? Is she with you?" Satura smiled back at me. It was a sad shadow of his normal smile, one, dare I say, tinged with fear. Ximsik City Tasat, he whispered. The translation came to me with startling clarity. City is dead. I grabbed hold of that broad instrument bell. The damned communicator had mistranslated. I caught hold of his hands, forgetting the sensitiveness of his finger lips. Ximsik City Tasat. Ximsik City Tasat, came the remorseless message, to be followed by the confirmatory City is dead, repeated in French and Spanish, the languages which we had used on previous occasions. Abruptly, the message ended. Satura eased his back against the rock and looked over this earthly paradise. For the first time I saw him in torment. In spite of my own shocked grief, I felt sorry for my friend. He had known Ksiti for so many years. He had known her all his life, as his sister, as a little girl, as a teenager, as part of his family, but most of all as part of his team. Whereas the relationship between Satura and Ksiti was based on many years, that between Ksiti and myself was the very short attachment of a few weeks. I looked at the troubled face of my friend and finally asked him how it happened. He burst out into a torrent of Itibiran words, speaking so quickly that the translation became affected. Everything he was saying about a planet Tagara, and an accident, was so evocative of Ksiti, that his words were lost in recapturing the image of her beauty. The memory of his sister was lost behind the terrible fate she and seven other astronauts must have experienced on a different world to ours. A tiny little metal sculpture, a cut-off relic in the form of a hand, holding the flower of the seven cosmic commandments, was all my friend had kept as a last reminder of his sister. He gave this to me and I shall treasure this last, delicate memory of a great woman as the most touching present I ever received in my entire life. He mentioned that this many thousand-year-old relic was of intercosmic origin and not from his home planet. The flower with the six leaves, and the round sunflower-type center, represents the offering of the seven intercosmic commandments God has made to all humanity in the universe. Mostly are women, he sadly smiled. Use it as a good luck item and Ksiti left it in my communication center before embarking on her own mission. I was sorry to hear that Mr. Huan. Several of the men and women I had known at the Mirim River base had also died at the same time as Ksiti. It must have been more than an hour that we sat on the isle talking, almost until sunset, which comes early in El Salvador, Central America. I shall never forget his sadness. The mental and physical turmoil caused by the tragedy to all of them must have hurt him terribly. What had really happened to my friends after taking leave of them on that cold morning of February 27, 1967? It would be impossible for me to inform my readers of the correct information I received during the rather short visit. Why he had come to visit me, I cannot explain either. But he came as a friend. Perhaps he wanted to tell me about Ksiti. Perhaps he wanted to know some additional information about this our world. I really do not know the exact reason for his last visit. Come to think of it, perhaps he only gave me the relic of the flower symbol as a last reminder from their world. A last reminder? Perhaps he wanted to tell us in this, his own way, to stop thinking of hell, purgatories and resurrections, of hypocrisy and religious castes, of contempt and playing this international religious roulette more dangerous than the Russian roulette. The odds of hitting the right paradise after death are 1,000 times greater. The death of Ksiti was the death of an astronaut, the death of a cosmophilosophic scientist. Her death, recorded together with the death of many heroic human beings, has become part of the great memory of memories, the great intercosmic computer brain which has functioned for many thousands of years on several planets. From what Mr. Satura said on that tropical afternoon, just before sundown, on the 15th of January, 1969, I believe that our own cosmonauts are heading for a great catastrophe. According to what Mr. Satura told me, I sincerely believe that our present methods of propulsion are absolutely wrong and will end in great tragedies. We must first learn to become friends with our sun. This is what Satura had pointed out again and again. Just as with the tragedy of his sister Ksiti, it is always easy to be wise after the event. As far as the disaster near the planet Tagra was concerned, my friend told me that they had taken every precaution. First of all, because of the many plants they were taking back to their home planet, they thought it necessary to separate the Tagra mission, which Satarai explained as a strategic mistake. The second, and biggest mistake, came from the memory of the memory computers, which had incorrect information about the magnetic type of interference by Tagra. Tagra's interference had caused the death of several other spacecraft, interrupting the positive power return from the activated control ship cells. But the accident had followed exactly the same pattern as an earlier disaster, many hundreds of years apart. Because of the geyser-like reoccurrence of Tagra's activities, the approach of Mr. Hue's control craft was believed all right. Reaching the orbit of the ill-fated planet, the negative power, necessary for Mr. Hue's craft to be kept out of the planet's surge, suddenly was absorbed by the planet itself, and within a split second the craft exploded. Footnote: all computers I was told are interconnected with some giant intercosmic ring computing center. Our out-of-space friends call Fatex. Read about Fatex in the second book. Chapter 20. Spacecraft over Central America. There are fashions in literature just as in clothes. There are fashionable crazes and movements. A generation ago there were teddy boys, now there are hippies and skinheads. There are the flower people, claiming apparently to be trying out a new attitude to life. It is with none of these, or any other, movements in mind, that I began writing about the Atibirons and their philosophy. I simply hope that my humble contribution, as a mark of my devotion to Xity, daughter of an Atibiron vice president, steeped in the knowledge of our earth-born composers, poets, religious leaders and scientists, herself a scientist of some accomplishment, may lead to a wider knowledge and appreciation of the moral wisdom she brought into my life. I still cannot fathom why I should have been selected from all Earthmen to befriend and help the visitors from Itibiratu, or why I should have had the experience of being introduced to their way of life. I am just grateful that this happened, even though I cannot rationalize these things correctly. Not that I have tried to do so. I know that most of what I was able to translate and write must seem like the travels of another Gulliver. Returning to my properly on that memorable 15th of January, 1969, I did not feel like talking to my housekeeper or the next door gardener, who was cleaning my little beach. So I stepped up to the garage, took the car and drove off towards the capital of this beautiful Central American country, but my mind was wandering. I have not the remotest idea how I went through the city traffic that night. I kept on driving until I found myself on the dusty San Vicente Mountain Road near Zacatecoluca, leading up to the village of San Pedro Nonualco. From a previous visit I remembered the home of a very good friend, and as it was almost midnight when I opened his door, I asked him if I could stay the night. I slept until almost 10 a.m. the next morning and was awakened by the shouts of the newspaper boys. They were yelling their heads off about a flying saucer having been seen over the capital and the San Jacinto hills that surround the lake where I live. I read the newspaper very carefully. It was the first time that I had serious and sincere witness to what I was writing about. Flying saucers over San Salvador, said the first page headline. Then, witnesses, having been on top of a tall building, described what they had seen. The fairly accurate reports caused something of a sensation. Of course, the newspapers did not report that Satarai had come to visit me, even if they knew, and grimly I reflected that if he had had the nerve to make a landing just a few miles from the great international airport of Ilopango, he could have as well asked for permission to land in full view of the entire Central American population. From the reports, it seemed that shortly before his visit on the rock, the spacecraft was reported over the Cerro de San Jacinto and had then continued high above San Marcos. The amazing thing is that the spacecraft had silently, and for quite a long time, stayed in an observation position directly over the extensive capital town of San Salvador, exposed to the vision of several hundred thousand people. The split-second landing on the lake, which I did not observe, because I must have just stepped up the Isla de los Dioses, was seen by a neighbor of mine a few seconds after those observations recorded in the newspaper report. The neighbor saw the craft coming down at tremendous speed and sitting as on an air cushion between the Isles of Los Camardos and Los Patos, exactly midway between my home and the Jiboa River outlet of the huge tropical lake. But what does all this mean? I am sure that if the Itabirans would walk through the kitchens and living rooms of my readers, very few would have the courage to admit to their neighbors, or the press, what they have experienced, seen and heard. Why? Not just, as I have explained before, because of fear of being called ridiculous or insane, but simply because out of every true report 1,000 fantastically distorted tales have been fabricated. And this is precisely what happened on the 15th of January, 1969, in El Salvador, Central America. First the true reports came in, the reports from the eyewitnesses, all sincere and serious citizens, then late at night the reports of made-up stories, the rumors, the far-fetched accounts of people having seen real monsters, out-of-space Draculas, one-eyed giants, of course. Some have seen only midgets of the size of ants creeping through their bedrooms. Others have called all this a lot of nonsense, because, in reality, the observed saucer, they swore, had been seen disembarking a regiment of Russian troops. I had lunch with my friend and because he had some business to attend to in the capital, we drove down the end of a dusty country road, returning towards Zacatecoluca and the big town of San Salvador. After having had some coffee with my friend in a small coffee shop, opposite the Grand Hotel, I arrived at my lake house in the afternoon. My housekeeper was watering the orange trees on the lower terrace when she saw me. "Señor," she exclaimed. "Are you all right? You did not come home all night. The automobile. I thought you had an accident." "I am perfectly fit, as you can see. I just fancied a night drive. That is all," I said, and went inside the house. She gave me a very old-fashioned look. The good woman did not know what to think of my sudden disappearance without my telling her anything. Her outraged expression clearly hinted that she thought I had spent the night with one of the casual beauties of the lake villages. I have never before this told anyone about the last visit of my friends. Until I had finished the manuscript about all this, nobody knew about my latest experience in Central America. But I have kept the headlines of the newspapers, and I have made several sound recordings of those witnesses who have seen the spacecraft and, in particular, one of my neighbors who saw the craft landing on the lake. I do not know of any person on the lake having seen the return of the spacecraft, nor do I myself know on which part of the lake Satura took his speedboat in order to be picked up. Contrary to what other spacecraft observers have described, the Itabiran control craft did not show any kind of illumination during darkness. Before I start to write this short biography of a great human being, let me tell you that the character of my friend, and I should add our friend, Mr. Satura, is only a reflection of the valuable culture all Itabirans enjoy. Satura himself was not an outstanding man if you compare him, for instance, with Mr. Hua, his second in command. His kindness and goodness was the same as the unselfish kindness and goodness of all the other astronauts. But as a friend, and as the man who has brought the wisdom of cosmophilosophy, of cosmic religion to this planet, Earth, the following description of his life may be as interesting as, for instance, the life of another great explorer, Christopher Columbus. Satura was born near a natural beauty spot on his planet, a place very close to the Itabiran equator called Cotasoti, in the neighborhood of the large biological research center and settlement called Xilox. By our reckoning, he was born in the year 1720, on the 25th of August. So, when I met him, he was about 250 years old. If we compare his lifespan with that of an ordinary human being, this would bring Satura to his early 40s, in the prime of life. He knows the approximate time of his own death, somewhere between the year 2210 and 2220, unless, of course, he is killed by some similar accident to that of which overwhelmed his sister city. It must be remembered that the ages achieved by our planetary friends are entirely comparative. whereas our average age since biblical times has been about 40 or 50 years, although the psalmist says that men reach 70 and sometimes 80 years old. The age of the prehistoric man was much less than half this. Therefore our friends, with their great biological achievements and physical evolution, attain a normal average age of several times that experienced by humanity today. Satara's parents are still living. They are retired biomedical scientists, and their home is at Xilux, a delightful dwelling by a beautiful river, set amidst lush tropical surroundings. He comes of an illustrious Itabiran family, for his grandparents were both famous people on their own planet, and gained the love and affection of all Itabirans, and the respect of the community, for their valuable work in discovering an extremely interesting new instrument by which life a process can be observed. Satara always spoke very highly of his parents, but his admiration was for his grandparents, who, as well as perfecting this wonderful bioscope, also carried out valuable research in the fields of biomedical and intercosmic technology. For a term of 7 years, Satara's father was vice president of Itabira too. Because of the renown of his parents and grandparents, particularly the latter, Satara was subsequently chosen to head various Itabiran intercosmic research teams. Satara had an orthodox Itabiran religious upbringing. In their spare time, both his parents were religious leaders in the Xilux settlement, where some 10,000 families lived in an expansive area covering something like 5,000 square miles of the equatorial belt. As a child, Satara was brought up by his parents until he was 5 or 6 years of age. Then he was introduced to the marvelous child education system that exists on Itabira too. I, myself, saw part of the system at work through the medium of the iCenter computer. Footnote: the combination of U-A like in the word Mr. Hua, together with the Egyptian word Ra, are some of our Earthmen's words surprisingly used and known by our out-of-space friends, is further evidence that out-of-space visitors have been on Earth thousands of years ago. In common with other young children, Satara was sent to an education center. This separation of such a young child from its parents may seem faintly repugnant to human beings, but the system is only the logical outcome of a child's own wish to be independent, to be put into a learning situation, from which it derives much pleasure. All creatures have this same wish for independence. The Itabirans merely provide the opportunity at a slightly younger age than most other civilizations. The Itabiran children seem perfectly content with this system. They are happy to visit their parents during school holidays from the time they are about 6. There is no false sentiment attached to this system, but there is love, love born out of understanding, kindness and respect. In all, Satara spent 20 years at various educational centers. This seemed a very long time indeed for a full education. But Satara pointed out that it took longer for a boy to develop into a man on Itabira too than it did for manhood to be reached on Earth. There is no unisex education on Itabira too. All boys and girls mix together from the time they are sent to their first educational center. They not only mix in the classroom but also in their outdoor games and sports. Often they run about in the sun quite naked. The Itabirans see all this as a preparation to keep them active, sporting, healthy and mentally clean for the rest of their lives. Sex is not explained in the classroom, but by an analytical study of animals under observation conditions. The iCenter education that young Itabirans receive would certainly not be possible for youngsters on Earth at the present time. But I was assured that everything that the Itabiran educationalists did was motivated by complete sincerity, in an attempt to obtain absolutely natural behavior. It is this approach that prevents them, for example, from having that feeling of guilt over sexual relationships which is so much a feature of Western civilizations on Earth today. At the age of 20, Satara was introduced into the serious, but always cheerful, pattern of general education. This included all accepted branches of scientific knowledge, from mathematics to chemistry, languages, literature and history, art and archaeology, psychology and philosophy, as well as many other fields of learning. The Itaberans believe that as we are not yet sufficiently developed or far enough on the pattern of evolution, we are not yet able to create something and to keep it in a healthy biological condition, in spite of our great technical achievements. We have not yet reached the proper understanding of the nature of God.